And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, you're going to get a little baseball primer.
I'm a big fan, but this is your bailiwick.
Well, a new baseball season has arrived, of course. Our hometown Miami Marlins hope to avoid another 100 loss season and also to avoid the cellar. But today we go back nearly 60 years to learn more about the other Marlins. They were a AAA minor league team. They were also a colorful bunch during their five-year existence. Joining us now is Sam Zeigner. He's a longtime member of the Society for American Baseball Research and is the president of the South Florida chapter. When you hear the term saber, that's what they're referring to. And those are the real kind of the statistics maniacs of baseball, right?
That's right.
Well, he's also written The Forgotten Marlins, a tribute to the 1956-1960 original Miami Marlins. Welcome to you, Sam Zeigner.
Thank you for inviting me on to Topical Currents.
It's our pleasure.
Great to have you. So, full disclosure, although I frequented the old Miami Stadium as a kid to watch my Yankees, I had no idea there was an original Miami Marlins team. So why do you think they were largely forgotten?
Well, I think time has passed. As you know, Florida is a very transitional state, and people come and go. Some of the people who've lived here for many years remember the Marlins. But a lot of people, their memories begin with the Marlins in 93 when Major League Baseball came here.
Right. So it's just one of those things that they're just not really on the map or haven't been until your book, right?
Exactly. And they have such an interesting history, and there were so many colorful people that were part of it that I think that people would really enjoy in understanding the history of the original Marlins and their link actually to the new Marlins.
Of course, many were disappointed when the so-called Florida Marlins were born in 1993 and they ignored history and instead of having the city of Miami on its uniform of having Florida. I've always been a kind of against states being the team name. Texas, Minnesota.
They tried to, what their strategy was, they want to get everybody involved with the team so that everybody
right.
relates to it.
Because they knew they had a big base in Broward and Palm Beach.
And actually, my experience with the Marlins when they used to be at the football stadium is that there was more people that would attend from Palm Beach and Broward counties than Dade County.
Yeah. Would you explain for our listeners, such as myself, who don't know what the minor leagues are, I mean, exactly what they are, like there's A and then there's AA and AAA, and what the Marlins were, where they fit into this?
Mm-hmm. Well, currently, baseball has A level. There's a split season, which is a lower A level, and there's three divisions within A level. We have your best A level, and then it goes AA, and AAA is one step below the major leagues. Back in the days when the Marlins existed, the original Miami Marlins, you would have everything from Class D, C, B, A, AA, and AAA. So AAA, even then, was one step below the major leagues.
Okay, and the Marlins were?
The Marlins, back in 1956, when the first original Miami Marlins came to be, they were AAA. They were affiliated first with the Philadelphia Phillies. After three seasons, they switched to the Baltimore Orioles.
Okay.
So they were a farm team.
They were a farm team.
But they weren't owned by the major league teams.
They were controlled by the major league teams, but the teams were actually owned. As an example, in 1956, Sid Solomon Jr. owned the original Miami Marlins, and later George Storer owned the Marlins. And in the final season they were there in 1960, Bill McDonald was the owner of the Marlins.
How about a history of pro baseball in Miami? I mean, even Miami Beach had a team, the Flamingos, or some of the other teams that were in this area.
Correct. That was part of the old Florida International League, and you had the Miami Sun Sox, which played in Miami Stadium, and the Miami Beach Flamingos played at Flamingo Park on Miami Beach. And the old Florida International League was a Class B league. It was initiated as a Class C league. It moved up one classification, and they were there from 1946 to 1954. Both Miami and the Flamingos were charter members of the league and were pretty much there up till almost the end before the league disbanded.
Let's talk a little bit about Bill Veeck, who operated the team. And, of course, a lot of things that he did in baseball. He's also known for having a midget pinch hit.
Exactly, yeah.
As an official batter for the St. Louis Browns, Eddie Goodell. I showed Bonnie a picture of that. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, kind of difficult to get that strike zone on a pitch hit, right? Okay.
But he had many, many innovative ideas, including bringing in Satchel Paige by helicopter.
Right. Bill Veeck was brought in after Sid Solomon brought the team. He realized that he had gotten in over his head. This was his first foray into professional ownership. And his good friend was Bill Veeck. Bill Veeck had previously owned the Cleveland Indians and the St. Louis Browns, but he was out of baseball at the time. Solomon was a St. Louis guy who moved to Miami. He had made his money in the insurance business. And he called on Bill Veeck to help him to run the team. And essentially, Bill Veeck came in and did many of the things that he did, as you mentioned, with the midget Eddie Goodell at bat. Bill Veeck was famous. He introduced fireworks at the game, in between inning entertainment, special promotions. All of that started with Bill Veeck.
He kind of like what we have today.
Yes, he was the father of all that you see today.
Well, how did they begin, though, the Marlins, before Bill Veeck came on? I mean, you said it was almost a coincidence that the team started. How did it start?
Well, what happened is Sid Solomon Jr. and his business partner, Elliot Stein, were in Columbus, Ohio in December of 1955, and they were closing a deal in a restaurant. Coincidentally, at the table, well, I should say at the same time, the Minor League Baseball was holding their winter meetings in Columbus, Ohio, at the same place where Solomon was closing his deal in the restaurant. And one night, I'm going to give you the shortened version of the story, he was sitting at the table unbeknownst to him next to a man named Don Haskey, who owned the Syracuse Chiefs, which was a AAA affiliate of the Philadelphia Phillies. And it was a financially troubled franchise. Well, in the course of conversation, apparently Haskey was eavesdropping on Solomon. And Solomon, at one point, in the conversation, it came up that Toledo had turned down an offer to move their team to Miami. At this, Solomon commented, "If I had a team, I could make a go of it and it'd be highly successful." And according to Bill Veeck from his book, Veeck is in Wreck, he leaned over the table, he tapped Solomon on the shoulder, and he said, "Sir, you've got yourself a team." And from there, Solomon reached an agreement, and he bought the Syracuse Chiefs under the understanding that they would bring them to the Miami area.
Tell us more about Miami Stadium. I attended many games there, and it was just a terrific place to watch a game.
Stadium.
You were so close to the action, and it had that famous cantilevered roof. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was very unique. There was no steel girders or any type of construction that would block your view. No matter where you sat in Miami Stadium, you could see very well. And the roof actually went from the first base to the third base side and actually kind of draped over this grandstand so that when you sat in either the box seat or in the seating, you were covered. Of course, you know, it rains a lot in Florida. And that was very important.
That was such a great design. I mean, for that time, too, to come up with that.
Yeah, the architect who designed that stadium, there's actually only one replica in the world, and there's a smaller version of that in the Dominican Republic right now, and it still stands.
We're going to have pictures on our website, too.
Also, if you'd like to join in with a call, you're certainly welcome. That's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. Let's talk about some of the other personalities. Of course, we probably still want to touch on Satchel Paige more, but Pepper Martin, he was famous as sort of a Ty Cobb kind of player. He was a member of the Cardinal Gashouse gang of the 30s and was a real rough-and-tumble guy.
Right. He was the ringleader of the St. Louis Cardinals Gashouse Gang, which was very famous back in the 30s. They won the World Series
Dizzy
in 1934. Dizzy Dean, Daffy Dean, Ducky Medwick, Lon Warnicki was a pitcher. He was known as the Arkansas Hummingbird. Gives you kind of a feel of what these guys were like. They were basically good old country boys. And Pepper Martin was the ringleader of the gang. They even had a group where they played instruments and sang. But when Pepper Martin came to Miami, he was very popular with the fans. And he actually, his career dated back to the old Florida International League with the Miami Beach Flamingos, the Sun Sox, and he also managed the Fort Lauderdale Lions.
I read that just before he died, his last assignment was he was the athletic director for the Oklahoma State Prison.
Yeah.
Really?
For being a World Series hero, then you're doing that.
He actually, after 1959, when he left the Marlins, he was very interested in police work, and he was going to run for sheriff, but he eventually came back into baseball.
And who was this Dalton gang? They sounded pretty colorful.
Yeah, the Dalton gang consisted of Seth Moorhead, Jim Owens, and Turk Farrell, and they were a bunch of pranksters. And they kept the Marlins loose. They were there during the 56 season. All three of the guys made it to the big leagues with the Phillies with varied success. Seth had a short career, but Jim Owens and Turk Farrell were pretty good major league pitchers. And to give you a little bit of a feel of what Jim Owens was like, he once was called into the Phillies' main offices and in front of Hamey, was the general manager of the Phillies at the time. And Jim had a bit of a drinking problem, and he was a partier. And they called him in, and they wanted to give him an ultimatum. And they said, "Jim, do you want to play baseball, or do you want to be an alcoholic? Do you want to be a drunk?" And Jim said, "Can you give me a week to think about it?" So that kind of gives you a flavor of those guys.
We're speaking with Sam Zeigner, and he has written The Forgotten Marlins, a tribute to the 1956-1960 original Miami Marlins on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back and take your calls.
Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Sam Zeigner. We're talking about his book, The Forgotten Marlins. Now tell me, Sam, what's the atmosphere when you go to a meeting of the Society for American Baseball Research? I guess that's a real party animal kind of guy.
It's not a real rowdy bunch, I'll tell you that. It's not the Dalton gang, that's for sure.
What do they do? What do you do there?
We have guest speakers who come, usually a ball player or an author. Somebody who's involved in Major League Baseball, and along with him or her, in some cases, we'll have presenters within our organization who do short 15-minute presentations on, for instance, a book they're writing or a statistical survey that they're doing or something on that order.
Now, your book is certainly in-depth. How long did it take you to research and write?
Hefting.
Almost 2 years from the beginning. I started in January of 2010. And I did it in 23 months.
And how did you research and gather all the info and find the ball players to interview? How did you do all that?
Well, when I got started, the first thing I did is I went to our public libraries are a great source of research material. And I went downtown to the main library, started looking into accounts in the newspaper from the old Miami News, the Miami Herald. From there, I started reading some books. And as I got more and more into the research, it really whetted my appetite, but I wanted to get actual accounts from the players. And I started researching and looking up the players who played back then. And I would slowly contact and find them. It took a lot of work, as you can imagine. Major league players, or I should say former major league players, are a little easier to find. Sometimes the teams have information, sometimes they don't. But some of the players who were not major leaguers, you really had to do some detective work, so to speak, to track them down.
Now, wait, and he found the original bat boy. I just want to ask, how did you find the original bat boy?
In fact, he's a friend of Paul George's.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually, he was one of the first people I interviewed, and it turned out he lived in Miami.
And his name is Tim?
Tim Anagnos was the first bat boy. He was with the 56 team, and then he came back also in 57 because the second bat boy missed some games. He got hit by a batted ball, I believe it was, and missed a part of the season, and Tim chipped in the second season.
Now, of the parade of players that composed the original Marlins, in your opinion, what player was the best in the major leagues?
Oh, there's no doubt that Satchel Paige was the greatest player that played or pitched for the Marlins.
And after him, say?
I would say probably Don Cardwell. He had a long career in the big leagues. He was part of the 69 Miracle Mets.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pitcher?
He was a pitcher with the Miracle Mets. And he threw a no-hitter in the big leagues for the Chicago Cubs, by the way.
Now tell us about this concert during the Vec days, and it was set up by Satchel Paige, where Cab Calloway and Desi Arnaz played at the Miami Stadium. And if you had a ticket, you got free entry, and 70,000 people showed up. And of course, the stadium only holds 13,000 people.
Was that in Miami Stadium or Orange Bowl?
No, you're probably thinking of the Orange Bowl game.
Ah, okay.
Bill Veeck, what his intention was to break the minor league record for attendance, which was 56,000.
Oh, so he brought in Cab Calloway and Desi Arnaz.
Right. And what he did is he arranged to use the Orange Bowl because that was the only facility large enough to hold the amount of attendance right. he needed for the game. So what he did, with the assistance of a gentleman by the name of Coy Poe, who was a promoter, is they set up to use the stadium. They shoehorned a baseball park into the stadium, and they hired entertainers to come. As an example, Cab Calloway, Merv Griffin, Gloria DeHaven was there. And they also had the commissioner, of course, of the International League and so forth came to the game. But the catch of the game was, of course, he had Satchel Paige, the star of the team, pitch the game.
And tell us more about Satchel Paige, because he has some amazing statistics. So talk about him a little bit.
Okay, Satchel Paige is basically the greatest pitcher that probably ever lived. That could be argued, of course. But he was a longtime Negro leaguer. He did barnstorming. He was amazing because most pitchers, you'd pitch and you need 3 or 4 days rest. Paige would pitch almost every day. And he had this arm that was just, it was superhero-ish. I mean, nobody ever saw anything like that. In fact, a lot of the ball players told me when he played for the Marlins is he would get under a spigot of water in the shower. And he'd run scalding hot water over his arm to keep it loose. And they said he didn't even flinch when he was under the water.
He used
snake oil, too.
And his ERA, which is that like the lowest?
Well, the first season he was with the Marlins in 1956, he pitched 111 innings, won 11 games, lost 4, and had a 1.86 earned run average at the age of 50 years old.
Yeah, that's an important fact.
And anything below 3 is considered pretty decent.
That's very good. And the International League was a pretty good hitters league, so anything was under 3 was very good.
And that opening night, at the opening night of the Marlins game in 1956,
right?
That sounds like quite quite an event.
Well, the interesting thing about it is the players did not know that Bill Veeck had signed Satchel Paige. The only people who knew were the upper echelon of the Marlins. So when the game started, a gentleman by the name of Thornton Kipper started the game. As the fans prepared to get comfortable in their seats and so forth, they saw a helicopter circling Miami Stadium. And nobody knew what to think of it, but one of those bubble top helicopters came down, and the players scattered. There's dirt blowing everywhere. It lands right behind the pitcher's mound in the infield. The door flies open, and out pops Satchel Paige. And some of the players commented, oh, shoot, that son of a gun took my job.
Yeah, right, I was going to say, because they had a starting pitcher that night, right?
That right.
was supposed to be somebody else.
Thornton Kipper was a starting pitcher. And actually, Paige didn't start a game till a few games into the season.
Oh, okay.
More about Mickey McDermott. I read that he had a tryout with the Red Sox when he was only 13 years old.
Yeah, Mickey was the quintessential million-dollar arm and 10-cent head. He was very rebellious. He was a character, very funny. His teammates always loved him, but management didn't. And when he was actually in Miami, he got in trouble with the law, speeding, drunk driving. And he even used to do a nightclub act when the Marlins would go on the road. He did it, would sing, for instance, in Havana. They loved to go to Havana and play. And he'd get up on stage and do his nightclub act.
And of course, this was before Castro. So the team played many games in Havana.
Oh, yeah, many. It was an 8-team league. They played, 11 games a year in Havana and then 11 back at Miami Stadium.
So what led to their demise? Were so short-lived or short-lived? What happened?
Well, this may sound familiar to Marlins fans even today before they moved into the new stadium, but every year they had to negotiate a deal with Miami Stadium to lease the stadium. And, of course, it didn't usually come out as well as the Marlins management would have liked. They also didn't have a cut of the concessions. The Jacob brothers owned the concession rights, so the Marlins got very little income from that. Weather was always an issue back then, as even now. Now with the new stadium, of course, we don't worry about that. And when you cut into their income, they had less money to sign players, and as time went by, the talent, they had a harder time signing very good ball players.
So they had fewer fans?
And the fans slowly dwindled as time went by because they had less success on the field.
Do you have any other writing projects in mind?
I have some things in mind. that would be related to Florida history. I'm weighing my second book project right now, and but I haven't decided on an exact avenue I'm going to go yet.
Would it be baseball related? Or?
Yeah, that's my wife says I'm obsessed with baseball, so it'll be baseball related.
Where does that come from, your passion with, I'll call it a passion instead of obsession. Where does that come from for you?
When I was a kid, my dad coached baseball, but really what the key moment in my life was I used to spend the summer with my grandparents, and my great-grandfather was a huge baseball fan. And we used to sit out on his patio at night. He'd get out his transistor radio, and we listened to the Reds games. But in 1969, he gave me my first baseball encyclopedia. And I literally got so into it that I still have it to this day, but the pages are just tattered and torn, yeah. and it definitely saw a lot of use.
Now back to the old Marlins. How about radio coverage?
Local
legend. I assume
there
wasn't any television for them. But.
They actually did televise a few games the first season, but Sonny Hirsch and Bill Durney did their radio broadcast.
Of course, Sonny Hirsch is a legend in South Florida.
Oh, of course, yeah. And this was his first. This was his start. And what's interesting is in those days, they actually did the road games in a studio. Bill Durney and Sonny Hirsch would go into a studio over the old Mayfair Theater. It was next to the Jordan Marsh store. And they would
in
go
downtown?
In downtown on Biscayne Boulevard. They'd go into literally a little box. This is what Bill Durney Jr., who I interviewed for the book, is Bill Durney's son. And they would have recording of crowd noises. They had a little bat that they would use and hit it against a stick when a batter got a hit.
Oh, wow.
But all the information was fed by ticker tape to them. So sometimes when the ticker tape went out, they would have to fill in and
there was a
improvise.
Rain delay
there
in
was a
Montreal.
Rain delay or something on that order, you know.
And how fast did the ticker tape actually keep up with actually play-by-play?
In general, it kept, you know, balls, strikes, general information. You know, for instance, Cal Abrams would lead off the inning with a single. Something on that effect, and it would just feed them all the information, and then they would fill in the color in between.
Actually, I think Ronald Reagan did some of that in his early days.
Yeah, he did for the Cubs.
So I hear you're a Pirates fan.
I'm a lifelong Pirates fan. Grew up in Pittsburgh. In fact, one of my things, I just spoke at Bradenton, Florida, which is a spring training site for the Pirates. That was always my goal to go up there and speak.
And you spoke about the book?
I spoke about the book, yeah.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us today, Sam Zeigner. He's been a member of the Society for American Baseball Research since 1997 and serves as the South Florida chapter chairperson for the last 7 years. He's a former sports columnist and an author. And his book is The Forgotten Marlins, a tribute to the 1956-1960 original Miami Marlins. And I have a website for that research organization. It's southfloridabaseball.sabr.org.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Okay.
Good to see you, Sam.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
And best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for being with us.
Food and Dining up next. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition, so you know what that means. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, I remember my first taste of paella in South Florida. It was heaven laced with aromatic saffron. I had never had that in the Midwest.
I guess not.
Well, Linda Gassenheimer is here, our favorite chef, author, and syndicated column. I guess we know what's on the menu today, then.
I guess you do. Can you smell it throughout the whole studio?
Yes.
Joe, I'm with you. I love the smell of saffron-scented rice bubbling in a large paella pan.
Your description is better than mine. Right?
Well, hello. Whatever it is, it's delicious. So when I found out that today is National Paella Day, who would have thought? Well, I thought we should celebrate and learn how to make the perfect one. It's a great dish for family, for friends, or for feasts. Carmen and Lola is a Spanish gourmet store, and it's also a caterer. And here to give us paella tips is their sous chef, his George Salri. Welcome, George.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody.
Nice to have you with us. And also he's brought with us his chef, Pilar Guerrero. Is that correct?
Yes. Hello, good afternoon.
Great to have you with us too. She made this paella that is sitting here in the studio. And and everyone outside the studio is lining up for
it. The newsroom has descended.
Well, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What is your favorite paella? Have you made one at home, or do you have any questions for our expert? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Email?
Radio at WLRN.org, or they can tweet us at Topical Currents.
I always forget that tweet, Don. Thank you very much, Bonnie. Also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. He gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read in today's Miami Herald. You can also read Fred's wine column. That's in today's Herald. I'm busy eating, sorry. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, first I want to let Joe know that we do have paella now in the Midwest, even though I have to make it myself sometimes. So naturally, we have to talk about the wines that go with it.
All right, sounds good. All right, Chef George, sorry. I have to admit, many paellas I've had have overcooked fish, overcooked meat, or dry rice. So tell us, let's start with the basics. What's the essential elements for making a paella?
Well, to make a perfect paella, the first thing you need is a pan, a paella pan. It's a shallow, thin pan that just transmits all the heat from your flame into what you're cooking.
If you don't, could you use a big skillet?
You could use a thin skillet.
It's the thinness of the pan that's
important.
It's
like a flattened wok?
Yeah.
Yes. But the paella pan is actually a little bit, it's got a, you know, it's concave on the bottom. So it's on a electric stove, it wiggles.
Oh, it does. I didn't realize that. So it's not absolutely flat. Interesting. No. Yeah. And so what else do we need?
We got the pan. You need rice. You need the right rice. It's calasparra. It's a short grain fat rice that absorbs water like nothing else
I've
ever seen.
Is that what this is?
Yes.
No, so I always thought we'd have to have like Valencia or any kind of short cut rice.
You could make it
as opposed to long grain.
You could make it with a short fat rice, but we recommend and we use, you know, the real deal, the Calasparra, or there's another brand called Bomba.
And that's the actual name that's on the rice packet.
Yes.
Okay. So now we've got our rice in our pan. What else do we need?
Well, you need whatever ingredients you want to make it, whether it be seafood or chicken. The one that we have today that we made for you guys is the chicken one, which is very traditional, very Valencia from the countryside.
Okay. And so now let me ask you, because I also have made paella at home. And what I do is I'll saute the fish, the chicken, the pork, whatever's going into the paella, and take it out of the pan. Because otherwise I find it just gets overcooked. So I get a nice sauté on it, and then I cook the rice. Is that no-no?
Well, there's no no-nos with paella.
Okay,
but
tell us.
I'll explain how we do it.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, you start from the big ingredients, the ones that take the longest, and then you add whatever, you know, as the time of cooking for each element, you add them in as you go along. So you start, you know, you get your pan nice and hot. You brown the chicken.
Use olive oil?
Yeah. You cover it with olive oil, then you brown the chicken till it gets, medium complected.
Right.
And then you add your vegetables and you start getting a nice glaze in your pan.
I want everybody to know, since you can't see him, he's cooking as he's talking. His hands are moving and he's showing us how he's doing it.
Now, I've heard that they also in Spain sometimes use rabbit and even snails. Is that true?
Yes, they do. The traditional Valencia paella is chicken, rabbit, and snails. You are correct.
Boy, snail paella, that sounds exotic.
It's exotic here.
For sure. So we've got our chicken in, and then do you add the rice?
Well, you know, after your chicken, you know, I'd like to run a tomato through a box grater, and
grated tomato.
Yeah, you make a you make space in your pan in the middle. You add your tomato. You mix it in with, you know, the rest of your ingredients.
What, I mean, do you have onions, garlic, anything like that?
You can use garlic. I would stay away from the onion because it softens the rice prematurely.
Oh, that's interesting. And Pilar's over here. She's shaking her head. Yes, she's
watching. We haven't heard from her.
She's watching everything you're doing.
Yeah, move in a little closer. There you go.
No, it's right. It's right. The onions is a problem with their eyes.
Okay, go ahead.
So after you get your tomato right, mixed with your chicken, you again make a space in the middle of the pan and you add like a teaspoon of sweet paprika.
Sweet, not the smoked.
Right. Well, yeah. It's smoked and sweet. There's a one that's spicy, but we prefer the sweet one because it just gives it a nice flavor to it. Uh-huh. It's a nice combination. Stir that in quickly because it'll burn and it will get bitter. Then you let that cook down and then you add your, I like to use water because I make the broth and the pan.
Oh, I see.
Because okay. The chicken's there.
Right. So you get the glaze out of the pan and you get all the flavor out of the chicken, out of the vegetables, and then,
And what vegetables have you got in there now?
We got, fava beans, green beans. You can use lima beans. You can use artichoke. It's very popular.
Uh-huh. Those fava beans are big.
Yeah.
Are they a special fava bean?
No, they're, I guess here they're
like more than an inch long.
Yeah, they're hard to find here.
Oh, okay.
But we do sell them. So
they have in their gourmet store. They're canned. They come in canned.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, everybody doesn't know that we're sitting here eating the paella that you brought for us. So to explain, we've got fava beans. We've got the chicken pieces. We've got the beautiful rice. This is really tiny little pieces of rice.
Yes. That's why the rice is so important. It just this rice is nice and chubby, and it absorbs water like crazy. You use a little more water than you would with any other rice recipe. It's about 2.5 cups to a cup of rice.
Oh, wow. So now there's something red here.
That's, those are piquillo peppers.
Okay. They're beautiful peppers.
They're beautiful and delicious. Everybody fights for the peppers, when you bring the paella out.
And I want to say that that when you brought the paella pan in before we all gorged ourselves on it, it was beautiful because you had the yellow rice and then you had the little pieces of chicken in it, and then you had these beautiful piquillo peppers all very prettily put around. Pilar, yes,
those are good.
She's saying yes.
Are those peppers spicy?
No, they're actually sweet and tangy.
Oh, that sounds good.
They're very sweet.
It's almost like a pimento, only it's big.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
And actually, they're quite nice to have. You can just take them and stuff them with some cheese or something.
We sell them stuffed also.
Oh. they make a great hors d'oeuvre.
Are they whole or do you cut them up first?
They come in a jar and they get topped and they come either in olive oil or water. These are in water.
So you're not getting any extra flavors in there. You're putting the flavors in yourself. Now, your pan had in it, very prettily, a whole ring of fresh rosemary.
Yeah, that just gives it a nice smell when you bring it out. And since we cover it, traditionally you finish cooking, if the rice is still a little bit tough, you cover it with either a wet towel or a tin foil, mm-hmm. and the rosemary just infuses the rice.
I was just looking at the saffron.
Okay.
That's what I was clinking around.
Actually, I guess on Joe's behalf, I should ask if you can make paella with bacon.
You can make paella with anything you like.
Or salt pork.
Well, name it after Joe if you do.
Well, now, Joe has been fussing around with this pan that you have here, and you call this a paella kit. So tell me what's in it.
Well, the paella kit has,
And this is for sale. People
yes,
can go
yes,
on online at Carmen and Lola and buy, have a kit sent to them or go pick it up or something.
And it even comes with the pan.
It comes, we sell kits that it's a paella in a box. All you need to do is add chicken or fish or whatever you want to make, or in your case, bacon.
The Spanish rice.
He's got this color.
That's the rice that we've been talking about, calasparra.
And then you've got the paprika. And it says sweet, dolce, sweet paprika, and the peppers. And as Joe was looking at this beautiful saffron, so tell us about the saffron, because it's, so many people will make a paella and they don't use real saffron. So to me, they've missed the whole thing. He's just gulped. So when I said that, Pilar, what do you think about not using saffron?
I think that it's very an special smell and a special flavor for the paella.
And of course, this has to be Spanish has.
And yes. How do you introduce that into the dish?
Well, there is a trick to the saffron. The saffron needs to be toasted.
What do you mean toasted?
Yes.
How do you do that?
Well, I put it in a tin foil on the handle of the pan for a few minutes before we need to add it in. So it gets, when you toast it, it sort of exudes all the flavor and all the color. Otherwise, you add the saffron and it does absolutely nothing.
So you take a few strands of saffron.
Right.
You put it in foil and you put it on the handle of the pan?
Yeah.
Well, that's a kind of thin handle. How do you do that?
make a little envelope. A tinfoil envelope and just slit it in the handle. For your listeners, it's a nice flat handle that will hold.
So that kind of warms the spice up, right, and brings out the flavors. Well, actually, with all spices, you should really warm them up because they give out their oils and their natural flavors. So, oh my goodness, we've been having such a good time here. It's break time. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking about making a perfect paella with Chef George Sowery, and we have also, he's the sous chef, and we have his chef, he brought his chef with him, Pilar. Nice to have both of you. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're celebrating National Paella Day. That's today, with Spanish gourmet store Carmen and Lola sous chef George Sowery, and he's also brought his chef with him, Pilar Guerrero. Yes, perfect. And he's been helping us make the perfect paella, but most importantly, we've been eating his perfect paella. It's just delicious, and my mouth's watering. Well, now for you who are wine lovers, the 7th Annual American Fine Wine Competition Gala is going to take place April 4th at the Boca Raton Resort and Club, and it's going to benefit Deliver the Dream, a charity. And it's a chance, if you love American wines, it's a chance for you to taste some of America's best wines. For more information, go to AmericaFineWineCompetition.org, a very fun and worthwhile gala. Okay, dinner in minutes time. Well, some of you at home may be just salivating and wanting to have a paella tonight. So I've got a quick and easy one for you to make at home. And you can celebrate National Paella Day tonight. It's a Catalonian paella. Now, I learned about this special paella at a restaurant in Catalonia where they make they make it with pasta instead of rice. And I've been told by both of you here that it's okay, correct?
It's perfectly fine.
Right. It's called Fed.
And the one with the soup noodles is called Fideuá.
Fideuá, okay. So for this one, you sauté some chorizo sausage, some onion, garlic in a paella pan, or I'm telling you could use a large skillet, and they're all nodding, it's okay. I add some clam juice, some white wine, and some saffron. And to make things really, really easy, I use orzo, which is a rice-shaped pasta. Then I cook that for about 8 minutes. I add some zucchini, some pimentos, some peas, and some shrimp, and I only cook it until the shrimp turns pink. It's very colorful, it's very simple. That complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And if you'd like another Dinner in Minutes for tonight, try the Mushu Pork Wrap. So it's a whole different ethnic delivery today. Mushu Pork Wrap with bok choy, that's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter, that's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, I want you to know that Chef has brought us some wonderful wine that we're also drinking here with our paella. So tell us about the wine we should be drinking, Fred. Are you there, Fred? Fred's gone.
As soon as I finish with that, I want to hear what wines you brought, because that will be interesting.
Okay, we missed you a little bit, that we had a misconnection, but go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, okay. To see what wine goes best with paella, you kind of have to turn to the old saying that's probably a cliche now, but that's because it's true, and that is what grows together goes together. So since paella was probably invented in the Spanish region of Valencia, you would presume the wines of that region would go nicely with paella. And that works with the whites, Chardonnay, Macabeo, Pedro Jimenez, and so on. But Valencia's red wines, not so much. They are, to put it politely, muy potente, very powerful, and even rustic.
I think they're agreeing with you here, Fred. Yeah.
So one popular, for example, one popular Valencia red wine is Monastrell, sometimes called Morvedre, and it has a thick skin, which makes the wines very dark and tannic. And, of course, Valencia's summer is an endless series of sun-blasted 95-degree days, which I can attest to because I drove across it in a convertible one time, and it really hurt. So Monastrell is powerful enough that it has a nickname. It's a French nickname. I don't know why. It's called Étrangle Chien, which in French means dog strangler.
That's what they call their wine?
That's what they call their wine. But the Spanish are practical people, so they softened their dog-strangling red wine by adding another local product, the Valencia oranges, plus sugar and whatever else they had lying around, and they created a much friendlier wine, or more accurately, a wine punch called sangria. And they even make white sangria from local grapes. And now there's a nice combination, paella and sangria. Now, Spain's other favorite foods to Americans, of course, are tapas, little snacks on small plates. And these can be anything from spicy chorizo sausage to hearty potato omelets and pungent olives. And, of course, you could never pick enough wines to go with each one of them, so this gives you permission to drink whatever you feel like, which is very nice. And Spain's a great place to do that because it has so many varieties. Steely white Albarinos, rich and nutty dry sherries, fruity Riojas, and so on. They all go well. But, of course, the Spanish wine that goes best with the greatest variety of tapas and probably even with paella is cava, which is Spanish sparkling wine. So, yes, Linda, I'm recommending bubbly with everything again.
Well, Fred, I was getting worried because I hadn't heard the bubbly yet, so I'm glad you got to that at the end.
Goes with everything.
Of course it does. Now, we've got wine here in the studio. So, George, why don't you tell them what we've got?
Well, today we brought a Ribera del Duero, which is a nice, hearty...
Well, wait, say that slowly.
Ribera del Duero.
Okay. And
Slower.
Ribera del Duero.
There we go.
And what kind of wine is it?
It's a nice, hearty red wine, full-bodied. It goes well with a meaty paella like we're having now. But the idea of having cava or something bubbly with paella is absolutely inspired.
It's inspired, so you didn't know about that.
Well, I do now.
Fred, you've got a convert here.
Yeah, Ribera del Duero wines are great. Some people call them Riojas on steroids because they're very powerful. They'd be good with paella, especially with chicken and things like that. Or maybe with those snails.
Yes, it would be.
And especially with bacon, Joe.
Whoa.
There you go. All right. So, well, let's go back to some of the how to make the greatest paella ever. One of the treats of a paella is when you make it over an open fire, the rice on the bottom gets nice and crispy, and that's kind of the treat everybody fights over. So what is that called, a socarrat?
Yes, that's called socarrat. Right. But I will give you a trick
to
getting it on a gas flame. A minute before your rice is set, just crank the heat as much as it can go. And as soon as you see a puff of white smoke coming out of the paella, turn it down, it'll be one layer of rice perfectly toasty at the bottom.
Oh,
now,
wow.
That is inspired. I always wondered how you got just the right crust without having it black.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it'll take a minute or so, no more than that.
No more than that.
But you got to keep an eye on it, I suppose.
There's a very fine line between burnt rice and socarrat.
Okay, and so what about an electric stove or something like that? There's nothing, the same way, you could do the same.
You can make do with an electric stove. I would suggest, that you actually move the pan over because the electric element will stay
hot. Continue.
So
once you've done your 1 minute, get it off the heat right away.
Do you ever make it in the backyard on a charcoal grill or a gas grill?
That is the Zen level for paella.
What level?
I'm sorry, the maximum expression of paella is to be able to get it done on an open fire.
Just like they do in the fields in Valencia.
Right.
Okay.
You become the Zen master of paella once you can get it.
You're taking Zen master. Okay, the Zen of paella. All right, that sounds great. So now, Carmen and Lola is a gourmet food store. Where is it located?
Yeah, we're located in Doral, right off of the Palmetto on 25th Street.
And if you wanted to cater something, we could call you and you'd make a wonderful paella for us?
Absolutely. We'll cater up to parties up to 100 people or, you know, down to 10.
Do you have a website?
Yes, carmenandlola.com.
Carmenandlola.com.
Okay.
And people, they'll send it out to people. You don't have to even go over there. Well, it's been really, really a tasty week here. Chef George Sauri, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having us.
Thank you for
bringing
us. And Chef Pilar, thank you.
Thank you.
You were the one
much.
Who cooked this wonderful paella for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great. As we mentioned, Carmen and Lola's Spanish gourmet store located at 7640 Northwest 25th Street. You can order online at carmenandlola.com. And you can have the chef make a party for you right there. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joseph, Cooper, and Bonnie, great to be with you, and you ate well today.
Thank you. Thank
yes.
you, Linda.
Right. Next week, we'll be talking with Thierry Isembert and Peter Kay from Thierry's Catering. They'll be helping us make our spring parties and helping us with Easter. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, that's WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1 is Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday we return with a special At Your Service call-in program about the latest in Alzheimer's research and treatment. And today's calendar, on this day in 1863, 151 years ago, the birth of Sir Henry Royce, co-founder of the Rolls-Royce Motor Company. His first car had 10 horsepower and two cylinders. Since 1998, it's been a subsidiary of BMW, with some 3,700 sold last year. This year's Phantom Drophead Coupe sells for $476,000. And on this day, 1977, 37 years ago, the worst accident in aviation history, a Pan Am 747 collides with a KLM 747 on a runway in the Canary Islands. 580 die, 61 survive on the Pan Am craft. One more before we lose our glitter. On this day in 1970, 44 years ago, the birth in New York of Mariah Carey, the best-selling female singer in history. She says Minnie Riperton was a big influence on her style. 3 years ago, Carey became an ambassador for Jenny Craig after losing 70 pounds. So we leave with the famous motto of Sir Henry Royce, whose co-founder was Charles Stuart Rolls, quote, "The quality remains long after the price is forgotten." An ad once said that at 60 miles per hour, the loudest noise in a Rolls is the electric clock. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.